Hi, I'm Willow Belden, and you're listening to Out There, the podcast that explores big questions through intimate stories outdoors. One quick note before we get started, November 24th is Small Business Saturday, where holiday shoppers are encouraged to patronize small, locally owned businesses. We'll be offering 30% off on all Out There merchandise that day only. Just head to outtherepodcast.com and click on the merch tab. If you want a reminder about the sale on the day of, just sign up for our email newsletter or follow us on social media. Oh, and I should note, we just got a new shipment of Out There t-shirts in, so we're fully stocked and we have some new long-sleeved options. All right, on to our story for today. We've all heard the paradigm of the country mouse and the city mouse. But for many of us, we're neither, or we're both. We're weekend warriors who live in a city, or we enjoy living in a bucolic suburb but only get into the backcountry a couple times a year. That's the thing about wilderness. It wouldn't be wild if we lived there. But what happens when you discover the depth of your love for the outdoors only after you move to the country's most populated city? How do you find outdoor adventure when the only nature you have access to is divvied up into city parks? And how do you ward off boredom and maintain a sense of excitement and wonder when the places you play or exercise become overly familiar? Halima Marcus has the story.
I have always been a person who loves the outdoors. Growing up outside Philadelphia, I spent summer days playing in the creek that ran by our house, making forts and climbing trees. In high school, I spent nearly every afternoon riding horses. But in college, my work-hard, party-hard lifestyle left little time for anything else. Even though my college was in the gorgeous Hudson Valley, I never visited the Catskill Mountains once. And after graduating, I lived in Philadelphia, which is not exactly the wilderness. So when I moved to New York City 8 years ago for grad school, I didn't think the adjustment would be that difficult. My life in Philly seemed like a fairly typical city existence. I lived on a quiet street lined with sycamore trees, worked at the Philadelphia Free Library, and spent my evenings going to shows and bars. Sure, I'd go biking in the park before work and spend weekends in the woods, but I didn't realize until after I'd left just how much the outdoors had become a part of my life. I arrived in Brooklyn on a hot day in August 2010. I had known moving to New York would be a big deal, but I was too focused on leaving my friends and family to consider how it might change the other parts of my life. I wanted to become a writer, and I thought New York City was the place to do it. But to the extent that I even considered it, I pretty much assumed my relationship with nature would continue uninterrupted. There were parks in New York, and Philadelphia was a city too, wasn't it? Plus, I reasoned, the outdoors hadn't been that big a part of my life. As soon as I arrived in Brooklyn, I realized I'd been mistaken. Getting in or out of the city was much more difficult than it had been in Philly. All of those bridges and tunnels with bumper-to-bumper traffic. It often took over an hour to go 15 miles. I thought back on all the weekends I'd driven to nearby state parks when I lived in Pennsylvania. Usually it was to do this obscure sport called orienteering, which involves finding your way to a bunch of different points in the woods using only a compass and a topographical map. The whole thing is a race, and to win, you have to be the fastest to reach all of the checkpoints, or controls as they're called, in order. I would have never discovered the sport if it weren't for my dad. He started orienteering in the 80s and had been trying to get me to do it for years. Growing up, I saw it as just some nerdy thing he did on the weekends, and I resisted joining him until after college. But eventually, I started tagging along. On the car ride up, he would regale me with his past orienteering triumphs. The time he ran by a small forest fire, the time he encountered a bear, the time he decided to wade through a river but ended up having to swim. He described how the first time he went orienteering, he remembered every moment of the course for days. He even dreamt about it. That's how he knew he was hooked. The stories were decorated with errors he had made and how much time they had cost. Best practices for pace counting, terms for the terrain. I listened eagerly. He told the same stories over and over, but I didn't mind. He enjoyed reliving them and I enjoyed listening, hoping they would improve my skills through osmosis. At first, I was too intimidated to go out by myself, so I followed my dad around through the woods. But over time, I was navigating on my own, jumping over streams, crashing through bushes, and scrambling over rocks, collecting stories of my own. Beside my dad, most of the orienteers I met were either children, military cadets, over 60, or Eastern European. At meets, it was rare to see someone else like me, a woman in her 20s. But even though I didn't fit in, I loved the sport. It occupied both my mind and body fully. I never lived so completely in the present moment as when I was orienteering. Between the physical challenge of running on and off trail and the mental challenge of deciphering a detailed map, there was never a dull moment. Work obligations, relationship problems, errands I had to run, those worries all seemed far, far away. And then there was the incredible feeling of empowerment and independence. To be self-reliant and alone, to better understand my patterns of thinking, there was nothing else like it. I even loved how orienteering made me different. I enjoyed my friends' baffled expressions when I told them I'd been running around in the woods, off trail. "What's that thing you do again?" they'd ask. "Geocaching?" For some reason, everyone always thought it was geocaching. I knew I wouldn't be going orienteering in New York City, but I wasn't worried. Philly was only a few hours away. I could drive down to visit my friends and family and go to orienteering meets with my dad. And the Hudson Valley had its own orienteering club to the north. But getting out of New York City proved to be such a hassle that I quickly realized I wouldn't be leaving very often. It took only a few days before it began to sink in that I'd have to find another way to exercise and clear my head, something I could do in the city. So I decided to take up running. Just 4 blocks away from my new apartment was Prospect Park. It's only a quarter of the size of Philadelphia's Fairmount Park, where I was used to biking, but it would have to do. So I put on whatever old sneakers I had and headed out the door. The longest I'd ever run in my life was maybe 5 miles. But I made it around the 3.5 mile loop with freshness still left in my legs. My grad school program hadn't started yet. I had no friends in the city, nowhere to be, and so I thought, why not? And I ran around again. When I reached the 15th Street entrance for the second time and stopped, I immediately thought, oops. The burning, tight feeling in my legs was extreme, unlike anything I'd ever felt. When my grad school program started a few days later, I had to walk up the stairs sideways to save my quads, which, it turns out, was a good conversation starter. Another writer in the program told me, if you can run 7 miles, you can run a half marathon. But he also informed me that I hadn't actually run 7 miles. Apparently, the park loop was 3.36 miles, so I'd only run 6.72. Fast forward 8 years. I've run 12 half marathons and done much of my training for those races in Prospect Park, which, at 200 to 300 miles of training per race, is a lot of miles around the same 3-mile loop. Like the guy in my program, I too now know, down to the decimal, not only the distance around the inner loop, but also the outer loop. And I know the distance from all 4 apartments I've lived in to the closest entrance to the park. As I logged the miles, I got to know every turn, every tree, every path, and every field. At first, I took pride in learning the park. I considered it my green haven and my solace, an oasis smack in the middle of the city. I enjoyed watching the changing seasons. In autumn, I would try to catch the first falling leaves to make a wish. In winter, I'd go for runs in the snow, taking penguin steps to cross icy patches. Spring was a honeymoon, when I smiled at daffodils and finally ditched the extra layers. And in summer, I'd wait until night for the temperatures to cool and run in the dark. It wasn't a specific point when the park became too familiar. I suppose it happened gradually, the magic lessening with every footfall. But eventually, when I thought of running in the park, I no longer felt like a run would let the air in. Instead, I felt restless and trapped. I wished I had someplace else to go, someplace that didn't require an hour on the subway or 3 hours in the car, someplace where I didn't know what was around every bend. Maybe it would be easier if I was one of those people who truly loved running. But these days, running has become, for me, similar to the way Dorothy Parker described her relationship to writing. "I hate writing," she said. "I love having written." I don't hate running, per se, but I don't always particularly like it, especially lately. I do it because it's the easiest way to get out and get some exercise in my city. And, like Dorothy Parker with writing, I do love having run. It balances my moods. It clears my head. It gives me a goal to work toward and a sense of accomplishment when I achieve it. But the act itself was getting old. To keep things fresh, I started picking new places to go for my training runs. I'd run home from work along the West Side and East Side bike paths, over the Manhattan Bridge, and along the Brooklyn waterfront. I developed a route I called Around Everything that encircled Prospect Park, the Parade Grounds, Greenwood Cemetery, and Sunset Park, stringing together green areas like beads. But even these new routes started to feel familiar. That loss of willpower and motivation, that feeling of being stuck, began to seep into other aspects of my life. Work became tiresome. Writing became a slog. I was living in a city with 8.5 million people who spoke hundreds of languages, a city home to the Big Five publishers and countless famous writers, where Dorothy Parker herself once sat around a table and traded witticisms with Harpo Marx. It was a city that once seemed so unreal and intimidating. How could it now feel so stifling and small?
Hey, it's Willow. We'll get back to the story in just a moment. But first, a word from our sponsors. Support for Out There comes from The Great Courses Plus, college-level classes that let you learn for the fun of it. The Great Courses Plus lets you stream courses on virtually any topic: science, history, cooking, mindfulness. You can watch them on your computer, your tablet, your phone, TV, or you can listen to the audio version with the Great Courses Plus app. Right now, there's a special deal for Out There listeners. You can get your first month totally free. Just go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/out there. One of the courses they thought Out There listeners would particularly enjoy is called Wonders of the National Parks, A Geology of North America. It explores each of our national parks and looks at the forces that shaped them, things like earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, etc. Again, to get your free trial of The Great Courses Plus, go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/out there. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/out there. This offer is good for a limited time only, so don't wait too long. This episode is also sponsored by Action Heat, makers of battery-heated clothing. Heat on demand at the touch of a button. You've probably experienced heated seats in a car, so you know how lovely those can be on a cold day. This is like that, but for clothing. Action Heat makes heated jackets, socks, gloves, hats, even long johns. They're powered by rechargeable batteries that last up to 12 hours on each charge and can also be used to recharge your phone or other gadgets while you're wearing them. This is a way to stay toasty warm even in the most frigid winter weather. Action Heat products start at just $39.99, and right now there's a special deal for Out There listeners. You can save 20% off your entire order by going to actionheat.com/out there. That's actionheat.com/out there. Or you can just use the coupon code out there at checkout. And of course, we have a link to all of this on our website. And now back to the story.
The morning of the Brooklyn Half Marathon this past May, I was back on familiar territory. The course started on Eastern Parkway, looped inside the park, and then headed down towards Coney Island. Races of this size inspire awe, and I always run faster alongside thousands of strangers than I do on my own. But still, while waiting to start the race, packed in shoulder to shoulder with countless New Yorkers in my pace corral, I couldn't help but wonder if we were all just there to release the tension that comes from living in a city as stressful as New York. It was a wet and miserable Saturday, and I ran the first half mile in an iHeart NYC poncho flapping ironically in the wind. The side of the road was littered with discarded plastic, ponchos like mine, raincoats, and trash bags with armholes cut into them. This was some of the worst weather I'd experienced at a race, but I pushed on, and I finished in not-so-record time before staggering home in search of pizza. Usually, the day after a half marathon is an unqualified rest day, the purest feeling of loving having run. But the day after the Brooklyn Half was different. A few weeks earlier, I'd heard about an orienteering event in Prospect Park and marked my calendar hopefully. It was a yearly event that I'd somehow missed for 7 years. It had never occurred to me to look for orienteering in Brooklyn. On Sunday, the sun was out, and instead of sleeping in, I peeled my body out of bed, laced up my running shoes, and went back to the park. The start was by the carousel on the far side, and I arrived a bit nervous. But like always, the setup was friendly. Just a modest check-in table with maps and a laptop, and another table with water and snacks. I chatted with the organizer and paid the registration fee of $7. I punched the start, then flipped over the map. To my surprise, I barely recognized the park I thought I'd memorized. As it turned out, reading a map of a place I knew so intimately had a disorienting effect. The color coding was the same as I'd seen 100 times before, the same as it was on all orienteering maps, but on this day, it looked bizarre. Instead of lush and rolling, as I knew Long Meadow to be in the late spring, it was a dehydrated yellow. The roads were beige rather than the dignified gray of aging asphalt. And the lake, which would become practically neon with green algae over the course of the summer, was an optimistic robin's egg blue. There's a concept in orienteering called earth moving, which is when you adjust what you see in front of you to match the map. You say to yourself, oh, this little knoll is probably the big hill that's supposed to be here. This wet area is probably the marsh. It's like wishful thinking, making the terrain in front of you conform to the map when it doesn't. And it's one of the many good ways to get lost. I saw that the first control on the course was on the opposite shore of Prospect Park's long, twisty lake. I knew that to get across it, I could run over Wellhouse Drive and then cut through the bordering field to find the control. I set off running from the start. My mind was clear and my legs were suddenly feeling fresh. I ran across the drive, through the field, dodging picnickers. I cut into the woods to the shore where the first control would be, ready to spot the familiar orange and white flag. But it wasn't there. I'd done what you're never supposed to do when orienteering. I had lost contact with the map. I had run from my memory of my park, the park I thought I knew so well, rather than the information provided. I stopped and studied the map, chastened by my error. According to my map, the control was located on the southeast side of a tiny peninsula on the shoreline. Further to the east was a small cove, and across the lake to the southwest, a small island. I say small because this was not the grand scale of the forest. It was impossible to get lost. But still, it wasn't to be taken for granted. I had messed up and I was losing precious time. The peninsula I was on looked like the one on the map. The island was sort of where it was supposed to be in relation to where I stood, and yet the seconds were passing and I had not found the control. I came back out to the trail to relocate, and that's when I understood. I had entered the woods at the wrong point and had not gone far enough. When I realized this, everything clicked into place. I saw where I actually was on the map, about 50 yards from where I was supposed to be. I no longer needed to move the earth to make the terrain around me look like the map. The two conformed to one another, on their own and without my interference. I find the control, sitting where the map had always said it would be, punch in, and take off back toward the field. Now I'm in a groove. I jump off paths at pre-calculated points, dashing into the woods like a squirrel. I run across other paths, with complete disregard for the park planner's wishes, from one side of the woods to the other, perpendicularly, like a bird. I am never more than shouting distance from another human, yet I explore these in-between spaces with childlike zeal. Places I'd previously run past without a second thought. I am reminded of how, when I was a girl, a simple backyard could hold infinite wonder. A mossy stump was a kingdom for fairies. A pine tree was a lookout perch for imaginary invaders. A babbling stream was a gauntlet for leaves and sticks. The back end of the course takes me to the northeast side of the park, and I run just inside the outer wall through brush and branches. Twigs and leaves get caught in my ponytail, a branch snags my ankle, and I stumble to keep from falling. I run right into the fence that cordons off the Prospect Park Zoo. The final control is just on the other side of it, but backtracking or going around will waste precious time. To my left is a tree stump, pressed up against the wrought iron fence. It's still slick from yesterday's soaking rain. I make a snap decision, and before I can second guess it further, I have one foot on the stump, and I'm grabbing a branch for balance. I have the other foot on the top of the fence, between the spikes that will surely impale me if I slip, and I leap out of the park onto Flatbush Avenue. It's about a 5-foot drop. Fine, more like 4. But I land cat-like on the sidewalk, next to a family on the way to the zoo. The child in the stroller is staring at me wide-eyed. I'm so pleased with myself, I flash the startled kid a smile and take off running down the sidewalk like a crazy person or a criminal. I'm beaming from ear to ear, sprinting toward the finish. When you live in New York for a certain amount of time, much of small talk is about 3 topics: rent, the subways, and whether or not you'll move out of the city. The latter is a conversation my husband and I have often, as we both continue to embrace the parts of ourselves that love the outdoors. But the conversation always takes the same shape. First, fantasy, imagining all the places we might go, and then reality. What will we do when we get there? Who would our friends be? What will we do for work? Recently, we made a decision many New Yorkers come to. We bought a second home upstate before even owning a first. During the week, we live our city lives, commuting to work on the R train, returning home to our rented 4th-floor walk-up, running in the park. On weekends, we drive 2 hours to Sullivan County, where our little red cabin patiently waits. The cabin is next to a series of state parks. The first time I hiked the closest trail loop, which is a 5-minute drive from our front door, I found myself consulting my GPS watch. I wondered what the distance was from one junction to the next, how much distance it would add or subtract if I took this detour or that shortcut. I imagined myself getting to know the trail so well that I could run it with ease, anticipating every ankle-turning rock. At the same time, my eyes wandered to the unfamiliar terrain around me, and I imagined running those woods too, under the hemlock trees where the forest is soft and open, avoiding the thick, tangled patches of rhododendrons, looking around the backs of boulders for that orange and white flag. As I caught myself having these thoughts, I almost laughed out loud. Here I was, having made this life-altering decision to escape the city, to integrate wilderness into my life, and what did I want to do? I wanted to map it. I wanted to memorize it. I wanted to cultivate it. That's when I realized that the pleasure of the outdoors is not just adventure and exploration. It is, in fact, also about familiarity. And it's the combination of the two. Knowing the woods well enough to feel like you belong, but not knowing enough to still feel that sense of wonder at being an insignificant creature on this earth, a dot on a map. It's that combination I seek, not one or the other. So when the weekend was over and I returned to the city and the work week and my regular road running routine, it was with a new perspective. Prospect Park was no longer a place to look down upon, some paler imitation of the real outdoors. It was, once again, what it had been when I first arrived in the city. A sweet gift to all of us urbanites with wild hearts. A little green patch to call our own. A place to get to know and visit often. It was, once again, and as always, my old friend.
That was Halima Marcus. She's a writer and editor living in Brooklyn, New York, and she plans to run the New York City Marathon, which will be her first full marathon in 2019. Special thanks to Alex Egerking for recording Halima's narration. We always like hearing from you guys, our listeners. It lets us know when we're on the right track, and it also gives us food for thought about things we could be doing better. I wanted to share an email we recently received from a listener named Emily about our episode entitled Moments to Waste. In case you missed it, that episode is about a woman who decides to ditch the traditional career path after college, and instead she heads to Colorado and starts building a life around seasonal jobs in a place she loves. Here's what Emily had to say about the story. Quote, "I had to write in to express my frustration with such a cliche and privileged topic. Maybe it strikes a chord because her story is so similar to mine, and I wish I could go back and tell my younger self to stop being so damn cocky. The entire piece is laced with a superior attitude the author uses to justify her lifestyle, as when she compares her satisfying life to her friends' sad, money-making lives. Please, the very fact that she can ditch cleaning to go hang out in a hammock or take a spontaneous weekend camping trip is testament to the fact that she's either financially fine or not being honest about where she gets her income. I'm tired of hearing stories of seasonal workers and writers who made it work by themselves. As someone who has led that life, I can imagine she probably borrowed money from her parents and ran up some credit card debt. Life isn't always rosy, even when all your friends write you and tell you how envious they are of your lifestyle. Sometimes you're sitting in your tent in Alaska, getting eaten alive by mosquitoes, worrying about your overwhelming debt and wishing for a bit of stability. I want to hear more of those stories. The real side, not the clean, Insta-ready versions of our lives in which everything gets wrapped up in a tidy bow and all the listeners are sent home with a nice moral." Emily, thank you for your email. We want you to know we have spent quite a bit of time discussing what you said, and we'll take this to heart as we plan out future stories. So thank you again for the feedback. If you have questions or comments for us, please don't hesitate to get in touch. All of our contact info is on our website, outtherepodcast.com, and we really do love hearing from you. Speaking of getting in touch, thank you to everyone who applied to become an Out There Ambassador. We received a lot of applications and we're super excited to go through all of them. We will let you know as soon as we've made some decisions. Thank you also to Mike Beverly, Travis Nation, William Graney, Jennifer Richards, and Nanette Nelson for their contributions to Out There. We are an independent production, which means we don't get funding from a network or a radio station or anything like that. Gifts from listeners are our single most reliable source of income, and we work hard to make your dollars go as far as they possibly can. If Out There brings a smile to your face or offers you some comfort during tough times, I hope you'll consider making a contribution of your own. Just head over to outtherepodcast.com and click support. And now it's time for Community Classifieds. Our classified section is a way for all of you to let each other know about events, books, products, etc. that you think the Out There community would enjoy. Today's classified ad comes to us from Metolius Basin Institute, healing nature one person at a time through empowering you to let go of what no longer serves you and discover your own true purpose in life. The Institute specializes in transformational treks to Nepal, where they focus on themes such as false summits and embracing masculinity in the modern world. They also offer nature-connected coaching sessions. To learn more, head to metoliusbasininstitute.com. That's M-E-T-O-L-I-U-S, basininstitute.com. If you'd like to take out a classified ad of your own, just head over to our website, outtherepodcast.com, and click Contact. There's a super easy form to fill out, and as soon as we hear from you, we'll be in touch about all the details. That's it for this episode. Our Marketing and Business Development Director is Alex Egerking. Laura Johnston heads up our Ambassador Program, and our theme music was written by Jared Arnold. We'll see you again in 2 weeks, since we now are on a fortnightly schedule, thanks to your support. In the meantime, have a beautiful day, be bold, go outside, and find your dreams.